Alrighty, folks, and welcome to the Chronicle Podcast channel and the first episode of the new year. So firstly, I would like to say a big happy new year to all of you. I hope 2022 is a fantastic year for you all, wherever you may be. Now, I do remember saying something along the lines of, surely 2021 can't be worse, right? Now, I don't want to repeat that, but I do sincerely hope 2022 is the year where we see an end to COVID once and for all. I am doubtful, but hopeful at the same time, that life can return to normal by the end of this year, but we shall wait and see. However, this podcast isn't about the future, it's about the past. Now, speaking of the past, within this year, according to the statistics given to me by Anchor or Spotify, the Chronicle Podcast, since switching over to Anchor, has increased by 120% in terms of listeners and had an increase of 263% of followers. So thank you very much, everyone. Now, as well as that, the podcast has released 34 new episodes, totaling 979 minutes worth of content, and by all accounts, 4 people listen to my podcast more than any other. Now, to quote Chandler's boss, Friends, all the numbers are going up, so I'm happy. I hope to see those numbers continue to rise, combining both the statistics given to me by Buzzsprout and Anchor between the switch of platforms. The Chronicler has a total of around 3,700 downloads, roughly. And that's within the first year and a half, so I really do hope that the show will continue to grow throughout the next year. And I do think I can give myself a pat on the back with that. So here you are. Now just remember that the podcast is available on other social media platforms such as YouTube. So be sure to subscribe there if you haven't already. I'm hoping to post videos as well as podcasts this year, but that's all in good time. So be sure to follow me on social media so you can see what I'm planning for the future and for this year. Now, I did mention there that 4 people listen to my podcast more than any other, so I want to say a special thank you to you 4. Now, speaking of which, it does make me a little sad that I don't know who those people are. So if you ever want to get in touch with me personally, feel free to give me a message on my social media platforms, whether it be Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or you can email me at thechroniclerhistory@gmail.com. Now, I'll repeat it again, thechroniclerhistory@gmail.com. But for now, let's get on with the show that all of you seem to really enjoy, which makes me feel very happy in sight, and that is Chinese history. So now we are on to episode 42 within our chronological timeline, and it is all about the Sui Dynasty. So the Sui Dynasty was founded in the year 581 and was a rather short-lived one, being toppled by the Tang in 618. Now one may be thinking that because the Sui Dynasty was so short, it must be insignificant. But that person would be wrong. The Sui Dynasty was significant in many respects, and it does mirror the Qin Dynasty, which I'll get to later on. The first of these significant respects is that it was the first time China was reunified since the short-lived Western Jin Dynasty back in the year 265. That means that China had been divided for over 300 years, resulting in war and chaos, as well as invasions from the northern nomadic groups, which erupted onto the scene from Central Asia. Now, according to a source I read, the Sui founder, Yan Jian, was a product of the mixing between the nomadic invaders and the Han Chinese in northwestern China. A high-ranking Han family intermarried with the Xianbei tribes, and voila, you have Yan Jian a few generations later. Yan Jian started off as a powerful general under the Northern Zhou Dynasty and was called the Duke of Sui, and he managed to establish himself in the north, and the Zhou Dynasty were beginning to fixate their gaze south. However, they were under pressure from other tribes up further north, in modern-day Inner Mongolia or Mongolia, Yan Jian was able to establish himself as a capable general in war and soon found himself becoming the top minister within the Zhou court. He was regent. Now, you should know by now, if an outsider to the imperial family is regent, the dynasty is in trouble. However, Yan Jian found a way around this by legally adopting the young Zhou emperor as his grandson, therefore claiming legitimacy to the imperial family. Everybody thought they could breathe easier now that this powerful general was now a part of the imperial family. Surely, there wouldn't be a usurpation. Well, sorry to burst your bubble there, sonny. Yan Jian only did that to get himself closer to that lovely, juicy imperial throne. And soon after adopting his new grandson, he kicked him off the throne, claimed a mandate of heaven, and with that, a new dynasty was born called the Sui Dynasty, or Sui Chao. Now, you may have sensed my sarcastic tone about the usurpation part there, but honestly, the usurpation was actually welcomed by the majority of the Zhou court at the time, because there was a lot of scandals around the imperial family, a lot of ministers were unhappy with the way the court was being conducted, and this new guy, Yan Jian, was able to sort things out, which he did. The only people who were unhappy with the overthrow were the imperial family, for obvious reasons. Anyhow, there was a new emperor on the block, and he named himself Sui Wendi, and he was adamant that he would be the one to reunify China. He had taken the northern portion, so like the Zhou before him, he was fixating his gaze south. However, just like the Zhou, before he could do that, the Göktürk Khaganate, I think, please tell me if I'm pronouncing that wrong, or let's just say the northerners of Turkic descent were the ones who caused the new emperor a headache first. They launched an invasion into the northern Sui in the hope that the new state was weak after a usurpation of power. They were, unfortunately for them, dead wrong. Believing the Sui would fight a defensive war, the Turks advanced stupidly forward without any caution, and what happened was that they were battered by a bloody counter-offensive led by the emperor himself, and by the end of the year of the Turkic invasion in 582, they were defeated in battle. To make things worse for the invaders, a pandemic seemed to have spread through their ranks, and to make things even worse for them, there was a split amongst their ranks, resulting in a civil war amongst them. Now it's important to note the Göktürk Khaganate were not just in modern-day Mongolia, they were spread across modern-day Manchuria as well, and they spread all the way across to Central Asia, bordering the Sassanid Empire. So it was a massive empire, but I mean, it was more like a confederation, so to speak. But anyway, the confederation was split, and they were fighting amongst themselves. So of course, the Sui court now found a very good opportunity to launch a counteroffensive, like I said, and a peace deal was signed. And now, the gaze of the emperor was, of course, the south of China. Now, surprisingly, it seems like taking the south of China was a piece of cake for the new emperor as well. He stormed in from the north across the Yangtze River with an army of around 500,000, taking the provinces piece by piece and knocking on the door of the last imperial capital contending with the Sui, which was Jiangkang, or modern-day Nanjing, and it was held by the Chen dynasty. But by the year 589, Jiangkang fell and China was reunified for the first time in 369 years. After reunification, the emperor wanted to make sure he could restore the good old days of the Han dynasty. But in order to do that, he needed to rebuild the country, which resulted in massive labour projects and a lot of suffering for the people. As much as the emperor wanted to emulate the Han, he was actually mirroring the Qin dynasty a lot more. However, for great things to come, there must be great sacrifice, I guess. So what great engineering products was he so intense in building? Well, the first and foremost was the Grand Canal, or in Chinese, Jinhang Dayun. The Grand Canal was a huge engineering project, which connects modern-day Hangzhou to Beijing today. The first emperor of the Sui initiated the project, and it is said that well over 1 million people were sent to work on the project, most of whom died as a result of the terrible working conditions. If you were to compare that to the Qin dynasty, you would find some similarities. The Qin had their own massive engineering project called the Great Wall, or Changcheng. And just like the Qin, the Sui also created something which would last forever and be called the greatest engineering project of the age, despite the huge loss of life building it. The canal itself remains to this day the largest artificial river in the world at a length of 1,764 kilometres, or 1,200 miles, with over 50 historical sites located on it. Now, unfortunately for the first Sui emperor, however, he died before the project could be completed, and it was his son, Yang You, or Sui Gongdi, who has seen its completion in the year 605. Now, the Grand Canal might have been the largest engineering project pulled off by the Sui, but it wasn't the only one. Indeed, they also built up sections of the Great Wall, because it needed repaired, to fend off any further invasions from the north. And as well as that, the new imperial capital was built at Chang'an once again, and that meant lots of palaces being built and things, which of course means there's going to be trouble later on because obviously you're building too much too fast there, and we'll get to the problems that this creates later on. However, very much like the Han and Qin dynasty, if you will, the later Tang dynasty would simply build up from what the Sui dynasty did. But again, we'll get more to that later on. Another great change that the Sui emperor did make was one about religion. And the emperor was Buddhist by nature and wanted to spread the faith even further into China. And as a result, Buddhism spread even further. And because of his willingness to sponsor the religion, the emperor managed to convert more people to this faith, which is, it was born outside China, it was born in India. And to prove this, the emperor wrote an edict which stated, "All the people within the four seas may, without exception, develop enlightenment and together cultivate fortunate karma, bringing it to pass that present existences will lead to happy future lives, that the sustained creation of good causation will carry us one and all up to wondrous enlightenment." Now, the mention of karma there is a direct link to Buddhism, for all of you who know that, and it does simply highlight that Buddhism was to play a huge role on the new state that the Sui Emperor was trying to build. At the same time, however, he didn't exactly brush aside Chinese schools of thought, such as Confucianism or Taoism, and he let Confucian bureaucrats run the administration of his empire, very much like the Han Dynasty, for example. He reinstituted the imperial examination system, which was critical for seeking the best members of society for top government positions, rather than just through bribery or connections, and it was almost like he was pleasing both Buddhists as well as traditional Chinese scholars at the same time by releasing edicts, especially for the populace in terms of Buddhist beliefs, but at the same time reinstating the traditional Chinese mechanisms of government. So now you might be thinking that Sui Wendi was, a builder, and he certainly was. He was trying to build up a new nation, a new order, and try to emulate the glory days of the Han. But he was brutal in doing so in terms of the amount of people dying on these labour projects, which made him seem more tyrannical, and people were comparing him more to the likes of Qin Shi Huang. And, you know, like the Buddhism thing, a lot of people did accept that. So again, like this helps the spread of Buddhism through into China. But, of course, what didn't help Sui Wendi more than anything was his military campaigns once he became emperor. So the first of his campaigns were launched towards Vietnam, and he did manage to capture Hanoi in 602, but the majority of his men died from tropical diseases on the campaign. The more disastrous campaigns, however, were those in the north. The Sui dynasty attempted to invade, and please tell me if I'm butchering this wrong, the Goguryeo Kingdom in North Korea. The reason as to why are summed up perfectly by Christina Lai in her article titled Realism Revisited, China's Status-Driven Wars Against Goguryeo in the Sui and Tang Dynasties. In the article, she said, the Sui emperors warred with Goguryeo because it refused to pay tribute to China. China's national capabilities and prestige were stronger than those of the Goguryeo Kingdom. So his resistance to the tributary system could have emboldened other smaller powers to challenge China as well. Now, one thing to point out, as I haven't mentioned it before, is what's the tributary system? It's basically a smaller country within Asia, like the Koreans, accepting China's superiority by paying tribute to the culturally superior nation, as the way the Chinese seen it. It was usually a win-win situation for both parties, as the smaller states could usually continue business as usual, and in return they just pay an annual tribute, and the Chinese wouldn't attack them in return. Now, this usually only happened when the Chinese were unified under one dynasty, like the time frame we are discussing now. So as the Chinese were rising once again, by all accounts, the Goguryeo were training the troops and piling the grain, and to ease tensions between the two, Emperor Wen wrote to the Goguryeo king, Gao Yuan, an edict saying the following. I receive the heavenly mandate, and therefore I must care for my people and land. You possess small land and less population, but I own most of the world. If I were to be cruel, I would simply send one Chinese general to fight a war with you and save all the trouble. Instead, I am giving you another chance to make things right. I truly hope that you understand my kindness. The king ignored the order from the Chinese emperor and began raiding a nearby kingdom, which is Sui seen as an upset to the intricate power balance which was beginning to unfold in the northern regions of Asia. As a result, the Sui emperor sent an expedition of 300,000 men to deal with the Korean kingdom in the year 598. It was a bitter campaign, where the majority of the soldiers died not so much from fighting, but from the extremely cold conditions they were sent into. However, despite this, Emperor Wen got his submission from the Korean kingdom, and all was settled, or so he thought. After the death of Sui Wendi in 604, the newly crowned Yang Emperor had some serious issues to deal with. The first was those Koreans once again. Emperor Yang discovered that the submission by the Koreans was only a strategic decision, and not entirely sincere. The evidence which made him come to such a conclusion was that letters were intercepted between the Goguryeo and the Turkish Khanates in modern-day Mongolia, presenting a danger to Chinese interests in the north. Emperor Yang then wrote another edict to the Goguryeo kingdom warning the Goguryeo king should pay tribute to China as soon as possible. If he does so, I will treat him the way I treat the Turkish Khan. If he fails to do so, I and the Turkish Khan will pay a visit to your country. So once again, the Koreans ignored the edict, and soon it meant war. Only this time, Emperor Yang wasn't like his father. He wasn't a military man. And as a result, the Chinese marched there with hundreds of thousands of troops, only to be defeated by the Koreans, not only in one campaign, but two. Emperor Yang called for a third campaign, despite everyone within the court saying it was foolhardy. However, Emperor Yang was steadfast in sending a third costly expedition to Korea, by saying, Goguryeo is only a small country and situated in the middle of nowhere. It now dares to occupy China's border territory and loot Chinese cities. I possess the moral high grounds to save my people and fight with you. If you recognize the urgency of the current situation, then you shall regret it sincerely and beg for more good luck. Now, one would argue that the emperor was stupid for going on this campaign, as he had already depleted the empire of so many of its resources, and he used the Grand Canal for these military operations, which turns out to be a complete failure. But, for a moment, I think it's important that we put ourselves in the Emperor's shoes. He was the Emperor, Tianzi, or the Son of Heaven. He owned, from his perspective, the entire civilized world in the East. Yet some small, inferior country, in his eyes, kept humiliating him. This, of course, was an outrage and a humiliation. A humiliation which he felt he personally had to avenge. So, the third campaign went underway, and the Koguryo Kingdom finally surrendered to the Sui in 614. However, the damage was already done for the Sui at this stage. So, you've seen the year there, right? 614. Now, the Tang Dynasty established themselves in the year 615. So, of course, at this stage, the Sui Dynasty was falling apart. Now, a combination of the factors which led to the Sui Dynasty falling are as follows. So the first was the huge taxes imposed on richer families for these massive construction projects which were underway, and in particular the Grand Canal. The human cost was bad enough, but the canal was undergoing serious issues, and according to a Chinese source, the first Sui Emperor wanted to complete the canal for trade and military purposes. The second emperor, however, only wanted to finish the project because he liked women from southern China. And rather than having them take a long land route journey, he wanted to get them to the lovely capital faster. Therefore, hundreds of thousands of people died simply because one man wanted the company of lots of women faster than usual. That, of course, would cause an outrage, not just amongst government administrators, but family members of the victims of the project. So now the Sui Emperor had ticked off the rich by taxing them heavily for big engineering projects, just so he could get some, and the poor for dying on said engineering projects, which were nothing more than pleasures of the flesh. And the cherry on the icing on the top of the cake was the failed military endeavours to the north, which again the rich suffered from for paying even more taxes, and the poor again suffered because they were the ones who died on said military campaigns. So as you can imagine, people had begun to question the Sui having heaven's mandate, and rebellions sprung up as soon as the Koguryo Kingdom surrendered in 614. It is said that straight after the surrender, the Sui army had to rush back to China just to deal with rebellions. And in this chaos, it was one clan who rose to the top. And yes, of course, it was the Li clan. And they are the ones who established the Tang Dynasty. But that is going to have to wait for the next episode, which will be published in 2 weeks' time. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And once again, thank you all for listening to the Chronicle podcast. And like I said, Happy New Year, everyone. Goodbye for now.